This was all her idea, the harness. She was, after all, an experienced mountaineer. They laid him beside the bus with the harness on. Then she and Hisako and Siegfried got on the roof and hauled him up as gently as possible. And then the three of them got him over the rail and onto the main deck. They would later move him up to the sun deck, where he would regain consciousness briefly, long enough for him and Mary Hepburn to become man and wife. Siegfried then came back down to tell the captain that it was his turn to get aboard. The captain, knowing he was going to make a fool of himself while trying to reach the roof, played for time. Jumping while drunk was easy. Climbing anything the least bit complicated was something else again. Why so many of us a million years ago purposely knocked out major chunks of our brains with alcohol from time to time remains an interesting mystery. It may be that we were trying to give evolution a shove in the right direction, in the direction of smaller brains. So the captain, playing for time and trying to sound judicious and respectable, although he could scarcely stand up, said to his brother, "I'm not so sure that man was well enough to be moved." Siegfried was out of patience with him. He said, "That's too damn bad, isn't it? Because we just moved the poor bastard anyway. Maybe we should have called a helicopter instead, and had him flown to the bridal suite at the Waldorf Astoria." And those would be the last words the brothers von Kleist would ever exchange, except for hup, and alley-oop, and whoops, and so on, as the captain tried and failed to get up on the roof of the bus again and again. But he finally did get up, although thoroughly humiliated. He was at least able to go from the roof to the ship without further assistance. And then Siegfried told Mary to get on the ship with the rest of them and to do what she could for Waite, whom they believed to be Willard Fleming. She did as she was told, thinking it was a matter of manly pride for him to climb to the roof without assistance. That left Siegfried all alone on the wharf, looking up at the rest of them. And they expected him to join them, but that was not to be. He sat down in the driver's seat instead. Despite his limbs jerking this way and that, he started up the engine. His plan was to head back for the city at top speed and to kill himself by smashing into something. Before he could put the bus in gear, he was stunned by the shockwave from yet another tremendous explosion. This one wasn't in or near the city. This one was downstream, and out in the virtually uninhabited marsh somewhere. Chapter 38. The second explosion was like the first one. A rocket had made it with a radar dish. The dish in this instance was atop the little Colombian freighter, the San Mateo. The Peruvian pilot who gave the rocket the spark of life, Ricardo Cortez, imagined that he had caused it to fall in love with the radar dish of the Valle de Darwin, who no longer had radar, and so, as far as that particular sort of rocket was concerned, was without sex appeal. Major Cortez had made what was called, a million years ago, an honest mistake. And let it be said, too, that Peru would never have ordered an attack on the Valle de Darwin if the nature cruise of the century had gone ahead as planned with a shipload of celebrities. Peru would not have been that insensitive to world opinion. But the cancellation of the cruise made the ship an entirely different kettle of fish, so to speak. A potential troop carrier manned, any reasonable person might assume, by persons who were effectively begging to be blown up, or napalmed, or machine-gunned, or whatever. Which is to say, naval personnel. So these Colombianos were out there in the marsh in the moonlight, headed for the open ocean and home, eating the first decent meal they had had in a week, and imagining that their radar dish was watching over them like a revolving Virgin Mary. She would never allow any harm to come to them. Little did they know. What they were eating, incidentally, was an old dairy cow who wasn't able to give all that much milk anymore. That was what had been under the tarpaulin on the lighter which had provisioned the San Mateo. That dairy cow, still very much alive. and she had been hoisted aboard on the side away from the waterfront, so that people ashore couldn't see her. There were people ashore desperate enough to kill for her. She was one hell of a lot of protein to be leaving Ecuador. It was interesting how they hoisted her. They didn't use a sling or a cargo net. They made a rope crown for her, wrapped around and around her horns. They embedded the steel hook at the end of the cable of the crane in the tangled crown. And then the crane operator up above reeled in the cable so that the cow was soon dangling in thin air, in an upright position for the first time in her life, with her hind legs splayed, her udder exposed, and with her front legs thrust out horizontally, so that she had the general configuration of a kangaroo. The evolutionary process which had produced this huge mammal had never anticipated that she might be in such a position, with the weight of her entire body depending from her neck. Her neck, as she dangled, was coming to resemble that of a blue-footed booby or swan or flightless cormorant. To certain sorts of big brains back in those days, her experience with aviation might have been something to laugh about. She was anything but graceful. And when she was set down on the deck of the San Mateo, she was so severely injured that she could no longer stand. But that was to be expected and perfectly acceptable. Long experience had shown sailors that cattle so treated could go on living for a week or more, would keep their own meat from rotting until it was time for them to be eaten. What had been done to that dairy cow was a shorter version of what used to be done to great land tortoises back in the days of sailing ships. In either case, there was no need for refrigeration. The happy Colombianos were chewing and swallowing some of that poor cow's meat when they were blown to bits by the latest advance in the evolution of high explosives, which was called Dagonite. Dagonite was the son, so to speak, of a considerably weaker explosive made by the same company and called Glaco. Glaco begat Dagonite, so to speak, and both were descendants of Greek fire and gunpowder and dynamite and cordite and TNT. So it might be said that the Colombianos had treated the cow abominably, but that retribution had been swift and terrible, thanks largely to the big-brained inventors of Dagonite. In view of how badly the Colombianos had treated the cow, Major Ricardo Cortez, flying faster than sound, might be seen as a virtuous knight as in days of yore. And he felt that way about himself, too, although he knew nothing about the cow or what his rocket had hit. He radioed back to his superiors that the Bahía de Darwin was destroyed. He asked that his best friend, Lieutenant Colonel Reyes, who was back on the ground, and who had turned a rocket loose in the airport that afternoon, be given this message in Spanish. It is true. Reyes would understand that he was agreeing that letting the rocket go had been as elating as sexual intercourse. And he would never find out that he had not hit the Bahía de Darwin. And the friends and relatives of the Colombianos, who were blown to Hamburger in the estuary, would never learn what became of them. The rocket which hit the airport was surely a lot more effective in Darwinian terms than the one that hit the San Mateo. It killed thousands of people and birds and dogs and cats and rats and mice and so on, who would otherwise have reproduced their own kind. The blast in the marsh killed only the 14 crewmen, and about 500 rats on the ship, and a few hundred birds, and some crabs and fish and so on. Mainly, though, it was an ineffectual assault on the very bottom of the food chain. The billions upon billions of microorganisms who, along with their own excrement and the corpses of their ancestors, comprised the muck of the marsh. The explosion didn't bother them much, since they weren't all that sensitive to sudden starts and stops. They could never have committed suicide in the manner as Siegfried von Kleist, at the wheel of the bus, intended to commit suicide, with a sudden stop. They were simply moved suddenly from one neighborhood to another one. They flew through the air, bringing a lot of the old neighborhood with them, and then came splattering down. Many of them even experienced great prosperity as a result of the explosion, feasting on what was left of the cow and the rats and the crew and other higher life forms. Quoth Mandarax, "It is wonderful to see with how little nature will be satisfied." Michel Ekem du Montaigne, 1533 to 1592. The detonation of Dagonite, son of Glaco, direct descendant of noble dynamite, caused a tidal wave in the estuary, which was 6 meters high when it swept the bus off the wharf of the Guayaquil waterfront and drowned Siegfried von Kleist, who wanted to die anyway. More importantly, it snapped the white nylon umbilical cord which tied the future of humankind to the mainland. The wave carried the Bahia de Darwin a kilometer upstream, then left her gently aground on a mud bank in the shallows there. She was illuminated not only by moonlight, but by sick, jazzy fires breaking out all over Guayaquil. The captain arrived on the bridge. He started the twin diesel engines in the darkness far below. He engaged her twin propellers, and the ship slid off the mud bank. She was free. The captain steered downstream toward the open ocean. Quoth Mandarax, "The ship, a fragment detached from the earth, went on, lonely and swift, like a small planet." Joseph Conrad, 1857 to 1924. And the Bahia de Darwin wasn't just any ship. As far as humanity was concerned, she was the new Noah's Ark. Book 2. And the Thing Became. Chapter 1. The Thing became a new white motor ship at night, without charts or a compass or running lights, but nonetheless, slitting the cold, deep ocean at her maximum velocity. In the opinion of humankind, she no longer existed. The Bahia de Darwin, and not the San Mateo, in the opinion of humankind, had been blown to smithereens. She was a ghost ship, out of sight of land and carrying the genes of her captain and 7 of her 10 passengers westward on an adventure which has lasted 1 million years so far. I was the ghost of a ghost ship. I am the son of a big-brained science fiction writer whose name was Kilgore Trout. I was a deserter from the United States Marines. I was given political asylum and then citizenship in Sweden, where I became a welder in a shipyard in Malmö. I was painlessly decapitated one day by a falling sheet of steel while working inside the hull of the Bahia de Darwin, at which time I refused to set foot in the blue tunnel leading into the afterlife. It has always been within my power to materialize, but I have done that only once, very early in the game, for a few wet and blustery moments during the storm my ship encountered in the North Atlantic during her voyage from Malmo to Guayaquil. I appeared in the crow's nest, and one Swedish member of the skeleton crew saw me up there. He had been drinking. My decapitated body was facing the stern, and my arms were upraised. In my hands I was holding my severed head, as though it were a basketball. So I was invisible as I stood next to Captain Adolf von Kleist on the bridge of the Bahia de Darwin, as we awaited the end of our first night at sea after our hasty departure from Guayaquil. He had been awake all night, and was sober now, but had a terrible headache, which he had described to Mary Hepburn as a golden screw between my eyes. He had other souvenirs of the previous evening's humiliating debauch, contusions and abrasions from the several falls he had taken while trying to get up on the roof of the bus. He would never have gotten that drunk if he had realized that he was going to be saddled with any responsibilities. He had already explained that to Mary, who had been up all night too, nursing James Waite on the sun deck, abaft of the officers' cabins. Waite had been put up there, with Mary's rolled-up blouse for a pillow, because the rest of the ship was so dark. At least there was starlight up there after the moon went down. The plan was to move him into a cabin when the sun came up, so he would not fry to death on the bare steel plates. Everybody else was on the boat deck below. Selina McIntosh was in the main saloon, using her dog for a pillow, and so were the six Cancabona girls. They were using each other for pillows. Hisako was in the head off the main saloon, and had fallen asleep while wedged between the toilet and the washbasin. Mandarax, which Mary had turned over to the captain, was in a drawer on the bridge. This was the only drawer on the whole ship with anything in it. It was slightly ajar, so that Mandarax had overheard and translated much of what had been said during the night. Thanks to a random setting, it translated everything into Kyrgyz, including the captain's plan of action, which went like this. They would go straight to the Galapagos island of Baltra, where there were docking facilities and an airfield and a small hospital. There was a powerful radio station there, so they would learn for certain what the two explosions had been and how the rest of the world might be faring, in case a widespread shower of meteorites had taken place, or, as Mary had suggested, World War III had begun. Yes, and this plan might as well have been translated into Kyrgyz or some other language that practically nobody understood, because they were on a course which was going to cause them to miss the Galapagos Islands entirely. His ignorance alone might have been enough to carry the ship far off course. But he compounded his mistakes during the first night, before he was sober, by changing course again and again in order to steer for the probable impact points in the ocean of shooting stars. His big brain, remember, had him believing that a meteorite shower was going on. Every time he saw a shooting star, he expected it to hit the ocean and cause a tidal wave. So he would steer for it in order to receive the wave on the ship's sharp bow. When the sun came up, he could have been, thanks to his big brain, simply anywhere, and headed for simply anywhere. Mary Hepburn, meanwhile, somewhere between sleep and wakefulness, next to James Waite, was doing something people don't have brains enough to do anymore. She was reliving the past. She was a virgin again. She was in a sleeping bag. She was being awakened in the faintest light of dawn by the call of a whippoorwill. She was camping in an Indiana state park, a living museum, a patch of what the area used to be before Europeans decreed that no plant or animal would be tolerated which was not tamed and edible by humankind. When young Mary stuck her head out of her cocoon, out of her sleeping bag, she saw rotting logs and an undammed stream. She lay on an aromatic mulch of eons of death and discard. There was plenty to eat if you were a microorganism or could digest leaves, but there was no hearty breakfast there for a human being of 1,030,000 years ago. It was early June. It was balmy. The bird call was coming from a thicket of briars and sumac 50 paces away. She was glad for this alarm clock, for it had been her intention when she went to sleep to awake this early and to think of her sleeping bag as a cocoon, and to emerge from it sinuously and voluptuously, as she was doing now, a vivacious adult. What joy! What satisfaction! It was perfect, for the girlfriend she had brought with her slept on and on. So she stole across the springy woodland floor to the thicket to see this fellow early bird. What she saw instead was a tall, skinny, earnest young man in a sailor suit. And it was he who was whistling the piercing call of a whippoorwill. This was Roy, her future husband. She was annoyed and disoriented. The sailor suit so far inland was a particularly bizarre detail. She felt intruded upon, and that perhaps she should be frightened as well. But if this very strange person was going to come after her, he would have to get through a tangle of briars first. She had slept in her clothes, so she was fully dressed, save for her stocking feet. He had heard her coming. He had amazingly sharp ears. So did his father. It was a family trait. And he spoke first. "Hello," he said. "Hello," she said. She would say later that she thought she was the only person in the Garden of Eden. And then she came upon this creature in a sailor suit who was acting as though he already owned everything. And Roy would counter that she was the one, in fact, who acted as though she owned everything. "What are you doing here?" she said. "I didn't think people were supposed to sleep in this part of the park," he said. He was right about that, and Mary knew it. She and her friend were in violation of the rules of the Living Museum. They were in an area where only lower animals were supposed to be at night. "You're a sailor?" she said. And he said that yes, he was, or had been until very recently. He had just been discharged from the Navy, and was hitchhiking around the country before going home, and found people were much more inclined to pick him up if he wore his uniform. It would make no sense today for somebody to ask, as Mary asked Roy, "What are you doing here?" The reasons for being anywhere today are so invariably simple and obvious. Nobody has a tale as tangled as Roy's to tell. That he took his discharge in San Francisco and cashed in his ticket and bought a sleeping bag and hitchhiked to the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone National Park and some other places he had always wanted to see. He was especially fascinated by birds and could talk to them in their own languages. So he heard on a car radio that a pair of ivory-billed woodpeckers, a species believed to have been long extinct, had been sighted in this little state park in Indiana. He headed straight for there. The story would turn out to be a hoax. These big, beautiful inhabitants of primeval forests really were extinct, since human beings had destroyed all their natural habitats. No longer was there enough rotten wood and peace and quiet for them. "They needed lots of peace and quiet," said Roy. "And so do I. And so do you, I guess, and I'm sorry if I disturbed you. I wasn't doing anything a bird wouldn't do." Some automatic device clicked in her big brain, and her knees felt weak, and there was a chilly feeling in her stomach. She was in love with this man. They don't make memories like that anymore. Chapter 2 James Waite interrupted Mary Hepburn's reverie with these words. "I love you so much. Please marry me. I'm so lonesome. I'm so scared." "You save your strength, Mr. Fleming," she said. He had been proposing marriage intermittently all through the night. "Give me your hand," he said. "Every time I do, you won't give it back," she said. "I promise I'll give it back," he said. So she gave him her hand, and he gripped it feebly. He wasn't having any visions of the future or the past. He was little more than a fibrillating heart. Just as Hisako Hiraguchi, wedged between the vibrating toilet and wash basin below, was little more than a fetus in a womb. Hisako had nothing to live for but her unborn child, she thought. People still hiccup as they always have, and they still find it very funny when somebody farts. And they still try to comfort those who are sick with soothing tones of voice. Mary's tone when she kept James Waite company on the ship is a tone often heard today. With or without words, that tone conveys what a sick person wants to hear now, and what Waite wanted to hear a million years ago. Mary said things like this to Waite in so many words, but her tone alone would have delivered the same messages. "We love you. You are not alone. Everything is going to be all right." And so on. No comforter today, of course, has led a love life as complicated as Mary Hepburn's. And no sufferer today has led a love life as complicated as James Waite's. Any human love story of today would have for its crisis the simplest of questions. Whether the persons involved were in heat or not. Men and women now become helplessly interested in each other, and the nubbins on their flippers and so on, only twice a year, or in times of fish shortages, only once a year. So much depends on fish. Mary Hepburn and James Waite could have their common sense wrecked by love, given the right set of circumstances at almost any time. There on the sun deck, just before the sun came up, Waite was genuinely in love with Mary, and Mary was genuinely in love with him, or rather, with what he claimed to be. All through the night, she had called him Mr. Fleming, and he had not asked her to call him by his first name. Why? Because he could not remember what his first name was supposed to be.
"I'll make you very rich," said Waite. "There, there," said Mary. "Now, now." "Compound interest," he said. "You save your strength, Mr. Fleming," she said. "Please marry me," he said. "We'll talk about that when we get to Baltra," she said.
She had given him Baltra as something to live for. She had cooed and murmured to him all through the night about all the good things which were awaiting them on Baltra, as though it were a sort of paradise. There would be saints and angels to greet them on the dock there, with every kind of food and medicine. He knew he was dying.
"You'll be a very rich widow," he said. "Let's not have any talk like that now," she said.
As for all the wealth she was going to inherit technically, since she really was going to marry him and then become his widow, the biggest-brained detectives in the world couldn't have begun to find a minor fraction of it. In community after community, he had created a prudent citizen who didn't exist, whose wealth was increasing steadily, even though the planet itself was growing ever poorer, and whose safety was guaranteed by the governments of the United States or Canada. His savings account in Guadalajara, Mexico, which was in pesos, had been wiped out by then. If his wealth had continued to grow at the rate it was growing then, the James Waite estate would now encompass the whole universe. Galaxies, black holes, comets, clouds of asteroids and meteors, and the captain's meteorites and interstellar matter of every sort, simply everything. Yes, and if the human population had continued to grow at the rate it was growing then, it would now outweigh the James Waite estate, which is to say, simply everything. What impossible dreams of increase human beings used to have only yesterday, only a million years ago. Chapter 3. Waite had reproduced, incidentally. Not only had he sent that antiques dealer down the blue tunnel into the afterlife so long ago, he had also made possible the birth of an heir. By Darwinian standards, as both a murderer and a sire, he had done quite well, one would have to say. He became a sire when he was only 16 years old. The sexual prime of a human male a million years ago. He was still in Midland City, Ohio, and it was a hot July afternoon, and he was mowing the lawn of a fabulously well-to-do automobile dealer and owner of local fast food restaurants named Dwayne Hoover, who had a wife but no children. So Mr. Hoover was in Cincinnati on business, and Mrs. Hoover, whom Waite had never seen, although he had mowed the lawn many times, was in the house. She was a recluse because, as Waite had heard, she had a problem with alcohol and drugs prescribed by her doctor, and her big brain had simply become too erratic to be trusted in public. Waite was good-looking back then. His mother and father had also been good-looking. He was from a good-looking family. Despite the fact that it was so hot, Waite would not take off his shirt, because he was so ashamed of all the scars he had from punishments inflicted by various foster parents. Later, when he was a prostitute on the island of Manhattan, his clients would find those scars, made by cigarettes and coat hangers and belt buckles and so on, very exciting. Waite was not looking for sexual opportunities. He had just about made up his mind to light out for Manhattan, and he did not want to do anything which might give the police an excuse for locking him up. He was well known to the police, who frequently questioned him about this or that burglary or whatever, although he had never committed an actual crime. The police were always watching him anyway. They would say to him things like, "Sooner or later, Sonny, you're going to make a big mistake." So Mrs. Hoover appeared in the front door in a skimpy bathing suit. There was a swimming pool out back. Her face was all raddled and addled, and her teeth were bad, but she still had a very beautiful figure. She asked him if he wouldn't like to come into the house, which was air-conditioned, and cool off with a glass of iced tea or lemonade. The next thing Waite knew, they were having sex in there, and she was saying they were two of a kind, both of them lost, and kissing his scars and so on. Mrs. Hoover conceived and gave birth to a son 9 months later, which Mr. Hoover believed to be his own. It was a good-looking boy who would grow up to be a good dancer and very musical, just like Waite. Waite heard about the baby after he moved to Manhattan, but he could never consider it a relative. He would go years without thinking about it. And then his big brain would suddenly tell him, for no good reason, that somewhere in the world there was this young male walking around who wouldn't be in this world if it weren't for him. It would make him feel creepy. That was much too big a result for such a little accident. Why would he have wanted a son back then? It was the farthest thing from his mind. The sexual prime for human males today, incidentally, comes at the age of 6 or so. When a 6-year-old comes across a female in heat, there is no stopping him from engaging in sexual intercourse. And I pity him, because I can still remember what I was like when I was 16. It was hell to be that excited. Then, as now, orgasms gave no relief. 10 minutes after an orgasm, guess what? Nothing would do but that you have another one. And there was homework besides. Chapter 4. These people on the Bahia de Darwin weren't uncomfortably hungry yet. Everybody's intestines, including those of Kazak, were still wringing the last of the digestible molecules from what they had eaten the previous afternoon. Nobody was consuming parts of his or her own body yet, the survival scheme of the Galapagos tortoises. The Kankobono certainly knew what hunger was already. For the rest, it would be a discovery. And the only two people who had to keep their strength up, and not just sleep all the time, were Mary Hepburn and the captain. The Kankobono girls understood nothing about the ship or the ocean, and could make no sense of anything that was said to them in any language but Kankobono. Hisako was catatonic. Selina was blind, and Waite was dying. That left only two people to steer the ship and care for Waite. During the first night, those two would agree that Mary should steer during the daytime when the sun would tell her unambiguously which way was east, from which they were fleeing, and which way was west, where the supposed peace and plenty of Baltra lay, and the captain would navigate by the stars at night. Whoever wasn't steering would have to keep Waite company, and presumably would catch some sleep while doing so. These were certainly long watches to stand. Then again, this was to be a very brief ordeal, since according to the captain's calculations, Baltra was only about 40 hours from Guayaquil. If they had ever reached Baltra, which they never did, they would have found it devastated and depopulated by yet another airmailed package of Dagonite. Human beings were so prolific back then that conventional explosions like that had few, if any, long-term biological consequences. Even at the end of protracted wars, there still seemed to be plenty of people around. Babies were always so plentiful that serious efforts to reduce the population by means of violence were doomed to failure. They no more left permanent injuries, except for the nuclear attacks in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, than did the Bahia de Darwin as it slit and roiled the trackless sea. It was humanity's ability to heal so quickly, by means of babies, which encouraged so many people to think of explosions as show business, as highly theatrical forms of self-expression, and a little more. What humanity was about to lose, though, except for one tiny colony on Santa Rosalia, was what the trackless sea could never lose, so long as it was made of water. The ability to heal itself. As far as humanity was concerned, all wounds were about to become very permanent. And high explosives weren't going to be a branch of show business anymore. Yes. And if humanity had continued to heal its self-inflicted wounds by means of copulation, then the tale I have to tell about the Santa Rosalia colony would be a tragicomedy starring the vain and incompetent Captain Adolf von Kleist. It would have spanned months rather than a million years, since the colonists would never have become colonists. They would have been marooned persons who were noticed and rescued in a little while. Among them would have been a shame-faced captain, solely responsible for their travail. After only one night at sea, though, the captain was still able to believe that all was well. It would soon be time for Mary Hepburn to relieve him at the wheel, at which time he would give her these instructions. Keep the sun over the stern all morning and over the bow all afternoon. And the captain saw as his most pressing task the earning of his passengers' respect. They had seen him at his very worst. By the time they docked at Baltra, he hoped, they would have forgotten his drunkenness and would be telling one and all that he had saved their lives. That was another thing people used to be able to do, which they can't do anymore. Enjoy in their heads events which hadn't happened yet, and which might never occur. My mother was good at that. Someday my father would stop writing science fiction and write something a whole lot of people wanted to read instead. And we would get a new house in a beautiful city, and nice clothes, and so on. She used to make me wonder why God had ever gone to all the trouble of creating reality. Quoth Mandarax, imagination is as good as many voyages, and how much cheaper. George William Curtis, 1824 to 1892. So there the captain was, half naked on the bridge of the Bahia de Darwin, but in his head, he was on the island of Manhattan, where most of his money and so many of his friends were anyway. He was going to get there somehow from Baltra and buy himself a nice apartment on Park Avenue, and the hell with Ecuador. Reality intruded now. A very real sun was coming up. There was one small trouble with the sun. The captain had imagined all night that he was sailing due west, which meant that the sun would be rising squarely astern. This particular sun, however, was astern all right, but also very much to starboard. So he turned the ship to port until the sun was where it was supposed to be. His big brain, which was responsible for the error he corrected, assured his soul that its mistake was minor and very recent, and it happened because the stars were dimmed by dawn. His big brain wanted the respect of his soul as much as he wanted the respect of his passengers. His brain had a life of its own, and the time would come when he would actually try to fire it for having misled him. But that time was still 5 days away. He still trusted it when he went aft to learn how Willard Fleming was, and to help Mary, according to plan, move him into the shade of the gangway between the officers' cabins. I do not put a star before the name of Willard Fleming, since there wasn't really such an individual, so he couldn't die. And the captain was so uninterested in Mary Hepburn as a person that he did not even know her last name. He thought it was Kaplan, the name over the pocket of her war surplus fatigue blouse, which Waite was using for a pillow now. Waite believed her last name to be Kaplan, too, no matter how often she corrected him. During the night he had said to her, "You Jews sure are survivors." She had replied, "You're a survivor too, Willard." "Well," he had said, "I used to think I was one, Mrs. Kaplan. Now I'm not so sure. I guess everybody who isn't dead yet is a survivor." No, she had said. "Let's talk about something pleasant. Let's talk about Baltra." But the blood supply to his brain must have been momentarily dependable then, because Waite continued to follow this line of reasoning. He'd even given a dry little laugh. He'd said, "There are all these people bragging about how they're survivors as though that's something very special. But the only kind of person who can't say that is a corpse."
"There, there,"
she'd said. When the captain appeared before Mary and Waite after sunrise, Mary had just consented to marry Waite. He had worn her down. It was as though he had been begging for water all night, so that finally she was going to give him some. If he wanted betrothal so badly, and betrothal was all she had to give him, then she would give him some. She did not expect, however, to have to honor that pledge almost immediately, or perhaps ever. She certainly liked all he had told her about himself. During the night, he had discovered that she was a cross-country skiing enthusiast. He had responded warmly that he was never happier than when he was on skis, with the clean snow all around and the silence of the frozen lakes and forests. He had never been on skis in his life, but had once married and ruined the widow of the owner of a ski lodge in the White Mountains in New Hampshire. He courted her in the springtime, and left her a pauper before the green leaves turned orange and yellow and red and brown. This wasn't a human being Mary was engaged to. She had a pastiche for a fiancé. Not that it mattered much what she was engaged to, her big brain told her, since they certainly couldn't get married before they got to Baltra, and Willard Fleming, if he was still alive, would have to go into intensive care immediately. There was plenty of time, she thought, for her to back out of the engagement. So it did not seem a particularly serious matter when Waite said to the captain,
"I have the most wonderful news. Mrs. Kaplan is going to marry me. I am the luckiest man in the world."
Fate now played a trick on Mary, almost as quick and logical as my decapitation in the shipyard at Malmö. "You are in luck," said the captain. "As captain of the ship in international waters, I am legally entitled to marry you. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here in the sight of God," he began, and 2 minutes later he had made Mary Kaplan and Willard Fleming man and wife. Chapter 5. Quoth Mandarax, "Oaths are but words, and words but wind." Samuel Butler, 1612-1680. And Mary Hepburn on Santa Rosalia would memorize that quotation from Mandarax and hundreds of others. But as the years went by, she took her marriage to Willard Fleming more and more seriously, even though this second husband had died with a smile on his face about 2 minutes after the captain pronounced them man and wife. She would say to Furry Akiko when she was an old, old lady, bent over and toothless, "I thank God for sending me two good men." She meant Roy and Willard Fleming. It was her way of saying, too, that she did not think much of the captain, who was then an old, old man, and the father, or grandfather, of all the island's young people, save for Akiko. Akiko was the only young person in the colony eager to hear stories, and particularly love stories, about life on the mainland. So that Mary would apologize to her for having so few first-person love stories to tell. Her parents had certainly been very much in love, she said, and Akiko enjoyed hearing about how they were still kissing and hugging each other right up to the end. Mary could make Akiko laugh about the ridiculous love affair, if you could call it that, she had with a widower named Robert Wojciechowicz, who was head of the English department at Ilium High School before the school closed down. He was the only person, besides Roy and Willard Fleming, who had ever proposed marriage to her. The story went like this. Robert Wojciechowicz started calling her up and asking her for dates only 2 weeks after Roy was buried. She turned him down and let him know that it was certainly too early for her to start dating again. She did everything she could to discourage him, but he came to see her one afternoon anyway, even though she had said she very much wished to be alone. He drove up to her house while she was mowing the lawn. He made her shut off the mower, and then he blurted out a marriage proposal. Mary would describe his car to Akiko and make Akiko laugh about it, even though Akiko had never seen and never would see any sort of automobile. Robert Wojciechowicz drove a Jaguar, which used to be very beautiful, but which was now all scored and dented on the driver's side. The car was a gift from his wife while she was dying. Her name was Doris, a name Akiko would give to one of her furry daughters simply because of Mary's story. Doris Wojciechowicz had inherited a little money, and she bought the Jaguar for her husband as a way of thanking him for having been such a good husband. They had a grown son named Joseph, and he was a lout, and he wrecked the beautiful Jaguar while his mother was still alive. Joseph was sent to jail for a year, as a punishment for operating a motor vehicle while under the influence of alcohol. There is our brain-shrinking old friend, alcohol, again. Robert's marriage proposal took place on the only freshly mowed lawn in the neighborhood. All the other yards were being recaptured by wilderness, since everybody else had moved away. And the whole time Wojciechowicz was proposing, a big golden retriever was